It's Jeanette here from Jeanette's TV. I'm at the Elevate Tech Conference in Toronto. And what a conference this is. 4 days of incredible learning, all kinds of very high influencers in the digital and tech industries, from fashion to food and everything in between, investments, health. We have so much great coverage coming at you. Please stay with us.
Like you, I've done a bunch of different things in my career. Written some books, wrote an article or two, and then built for the last 4 or 5 years, built a software company and then sold it to ADP. And obviously that's tremendously interesting and exciting. A lot of you do the same sorts of things. What I'm here though is, I'm not really here as an entrepreneur or as a writer, I'm here as a researcher. Specifically, a researcher around things about people at work that are really important but that you can't count. Things like talent. Things like engagement, things like performance, knowledge worker performance. How do you measure things that you can't count? I did that at Gallup, and now I run the ADP Research Institute, and that's all that we focus on. How do you measure things at work that you can't count? And in doing that, we take a very particular approach to it called a free-thinking research approach, which sounds like this. If you want to learn about great entrepreneurs, take your theory aside and study great entrepreneurs. Study how they actually are in the real world. If you want to learn about what great software engineers look like, put your theory and your dogma aside and just study excellence as it exists in the real world. You want to learn about great teachers, put the theory aside, just interview great teachers as they live in the real world. Which, as I say that, I realize that just sounds so crushingly obvious. You've got to wonder why you would ever do anything else. And yet, if you look around, what you'll see is that we don't do that. To learn about excellence in the world today, we study failure and then invert it. So in order to learn about health, we study disease. In order to learn about joy and meaning and wisdom in life, we study neurosis and depression. To learn how to keep our employees really engaged, we do exit interviews with the ones that leave. Everywhere you look, we seem to believe that good is just the opposite of bad. If you want good, study bad and flip it. We're wrong. If you study bad and flip it, you get not bad. And that's just different, isn't it, than good or excellent? I know the theory, of course, today is that if you're not failing, I mean, the Silicon Valley theory would be fail, fail fast. But beyond the obvious point that if all you're doing is failing and failing fast, you are, by definition, a failure. You learn nothing about excellence from studying failure. That's a big takeaway for all of us. All of you in the room here today, you're all researchers. You're all trying to create more excellence, whether it's excellence experience, as we heard this morning, excellent businesses. Excellent. So you're all trying to create that. The point for all of us is you'll learn nothing about what that is from studying failure. Failure tells us nothing about success. It tells us a lot about failure. And if you want to study it, that's fine. Just like if you wanted to study depression to learn about it, that's good, but it won't tell you much about happiness. Now, we could take examples from business, lots of examples from business, but let's take one from your personal lives. Marriage. Most marriage therapy is based on the idea that a good marriage is the opposite of a bad marriage. If you want a really good marriage, study the rotten marriages and then say, don't do that. And when you study the rotten marriages, although every rotten marriage or every marriage indeed is rotten in its own way, if you study the really, that's sort of a joke, every rotten marriage is rotten in its own way, although everything is different in terms of the uniqueness of that marriage, if you study the really bad relationships, they do actually have one thing in common. In all the really bad relationships and marriages, people argue a lot. I know. I was shocked as well. No, but it's true. It's true. In all the really rotten relationships, people argue a lot. So following the logic that good is just the opposite of bad, if you want a really good relationship, you should not fight. And yet, and you know where I'm going with this. If you study the really great relationships and you count the fights, the researchers actually just counted the fights. When you started to fight, there was a little pager on your back and you'd immediately run and call the researchers up and say, we're fighting now, which I'm sure helped the fight tremendously. But they counted the fights in the really great ones and the really rotten relationships. And it turns out there's absolutely no statistically significant difference at all between the number of fights in a great relationship and the number of fights in a rotten one. It turns out the difference between a great relationship and a rotten one isn't the number of fights, it's what happens between the fights. Some of you have experienced this. In a rotten relationship, the fight is a confirmation of the need to protect yourself. And you lean back and back and back and back at each fight, pushing you further away until one day you wake up and you're physically and psychologically separated. And somehow in the really great relationships, each fight is an opportunity to reach toward one another for greater intimacy or curiosity or connection. So each fight actually, weirdly, brings you closer together. Now, I don't know what it is that brings two people closer together in the space between the fights. That's a different presentation for a different time. Whatever it is that draws people back together, you don't learn anything about it from studying rotten marriages. Excellence, and this is, if you just take one thing away from my presentation this morning, take this. Excellence has its own configuration. Excellence has its own pattern. If you want to understand why customers really love you, don't study the ones that hate you. If you want to understand why your employees stay with you, don't do exit interviews with the ones that leave. Not that that's not worthy of study, it's just that that tells you nothing about that. If you want to take a free-thinking research approach to excellence, put your dogma aside and study it as it really is. Harvard Business Review came to us a little while ago and said, could you take that free-thinking approach and apply it to the performance review? How many of you ever participated in a performance review? Yeah, it's great, isn't it? How many of you ever participated in a performance review where you've got ratings of some kind, some sort of ratings? Yeah, almost all of us are mediated in our lives by a rating of some kind. So we wrote this piece, which basically said if you take a free-thinking research approach to ratings, what you find is that all performance reviews are based on the idea that I can learn to become a reliable rater of you. You're in the front row and you're here. What's your name?
I'm Richard.
Richard. So I'm supposedly, apparently, able to become a reliable rater of Richard. Turns out, though, there's about 40 years of research that shows that every one of you in this room is a horribly unreliable rater of Richard. Not just of Richard, of anybody. And I'm not talking about unconscious rater bias toward gender or race or age. It's almost like when you rate him, you actually just can't see him at all. We know this because if I was trying to rate you, Richard, on strategic thinking, and let's say there are 6 behavioral questions on strategic thinking, it turns out there's a pattern to my ratings. There's a pattern. If I was really seeing you, when I looked at someone else and rated you, the pattern should change because now I'm looking at a different person. What's your name?
Julia.
So now I'm looking at Julia, the pattern should change. Then I'm looking at you, the pattern should change again. What happens in the math is it doesn't. My pattern of ratings just moves with me. I have an idiosyncratic pattern of rating. I might be a tight little rater, all clustered in the middle. I might be one of those wild and crazy raters that uses all 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I might be skewed right, because I'm generous. Or skewed left, because I'm sort of tough. By the way, I don't know. But I have an idiosyncratic pattern of rating, and it moves with me. This effect, some of you like effects, this effect is big. More than 60% of my rating of Richard is a function of me, not of Richard. It's called the idiosyncratic rater effect, if you're interested. But what it means, of course, is that my rating of you reflects me, not you, which is weird for you, because we pay you, or promote you, or train you, or fire you, based upon my rating of you. A couple of months ago, 700 folks at Tesla were laid off, all based on their performance ratings, which is kind of annoying for them because their ratings reflected their manager doing the rating, not them. That's a disaster for all of you that live in a performance rating system where your money, your promotion opportunities, your deployment, your growth, your career is mediated through ratings. You need to know all of those ratings don't measure something slightly wrong. They measure 180 degrees the wrong thing. And we're moving headlong into a world of big data where we take that garbage data and shove it into a human capital management system, and then your entire careers are based on data that reflects not you, but the person doing the rating. Now, some of you may go, look, I know you're an idiosyncratic rater of Richard Marcus, but don't worry. We'll add 6 more people. That's called a 360. How many of you have ever participated in any sort of 360 survey? Yeah, the idea is, right, that you, Marcus, are kind of idiosyncratic. We have 5 more people, and we'll get a true view, a vision of who Richard is. The problem, of course, is that I'm idiosyncratic in my rating. I'm a bad data source of you. We add 6 more bad data sources, and you get 6 bad data sources added together. It doesn't magically turn into good data. For those of you that missed that day in math, there's only 2 sources of error in the world, random and systematic. Random, you can remove by adding more data sources, but systematic, you don't. The more data sources you add, the worse the error gets. Every one of you that's ever participated in a consensus meeting or a calibration session or a 360, all the data's all bad. systematically bad. It's like asking six colorblind people to rate the redness of a rose. You don't get closer to the redness of the rose because they're all colorblind. When it comes to rating other people, we're all colorblind. We wrote this. It caused a bit of a stir because, frankly, every company uses bad data on their people. They came back and they said, could you take a look at feedback and whether or not when you take a free-thinking research approach to feedback, do you actually see whether or not feedback helps people get better? And the data on this is unequivocal. I won't read the whole thing to you, but the answer is no. Hence, I guess, the punching bag. If you want to see that all played out, you can see it in there. But we put this on. Of course, this caused a huge stir because coming soon to a phone near you is some app that enables you to get feedback on anyone or give feedback to anyone on anything at any time. If you work for Bridgewater Associates, they'll keep that data on you forever in something called a transparency library, which sounds Orwellianly horrible. But there'll be more of this. Somebody's going to get feedback on you, give feedback to you on anything more, and it'll be kept on you forever, and it's terrible. So we came to this got a ton of play. So HBR came back to us and said, could you take all of the bits of people at work and take a free-thinking research approach to them and just have a look at how we currently do people at work? We're just about to take all of our core assumptions about people at work and maximize them at great scale through AI and machine learning. And now, of course, driven by algorithms, but algorithms are just assumptions turned into math, as many of you know. So what are our core assumptions about people? Clearly, at the moment, we're not doing it right. As I mentioned, I run the ADP Research Institute. We've just done this 19-country study measuring engagement around the world. And although it varies a little bit, China's the lowest, least engaged country in the world. Canada actually is not too bad. About 18% of people in Canada fully engaged at work. 18% of you. 6% of China, by the way. So whether you're looking at China or Canada, around the world, we're less than 20% of people are fully engaged at work. Given all the money and the effort and the energy that we've thrown at that, per-person productivity hasn't budged in Canada for 40 years. We are clearly doing something really wrong about people at work. Turns out, when you take a free-thinking research approach to people, there's an awful lot of things that we feel like absolutely true that aren't. And as this chap said, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble, it's what you know for sure that just ain't so. It's Mark Twain. Actually, truth be told, it isn't Mark Twain who said that. This is one of those other things that you know for sure that just ain't so. We're pretty sure someone said that around the time of Mark Twain, but it wasn't Mark Twain. So this actually serves as an example of itself. Things we know for sure that just ain't so. You could call these things misconceptions, or I guess if you were generous, you could call them myths. I'm going to call them lies, because they're pushed at you really hard, almost as though somebody has an agenda. Why do we have less than 16, 17% of people fully engaged at work? When many of you are team members or team leaders, you want to do well? Why are we so bad at getting the best out of one another? Because these lies are pushed at you. You're fed a pack of lies. How many lies in a pack, I hear you ask? 9, as it turns out, which is lucky, because that's what I call the book. So that was lucky. There's 9 of them. I wrote this with Ashley Goodall, who runs leadership and team intelligence at Cisco, because we wanted to take a 140,000-person organization like Cisco and go, how does this work in a huge tech organization like that's going through a big transformation, hardware to software? How do these lies live? I'm going to show you these 9. We got lunch right after this, so I'm standing between you and lunch. I'm going to try and be brief and effective, but I'm not going to go through all 9 because I think it'll test your patience. I'm going to show the 9 lies quickly, and then dive into one of them, and then explain it a little bit, and then we'll be done for lunch. Is that all right? Okay. I warn you, these are going to look like truths. These lies will look like truths. And some of you will be annoyed because you'll want to dive into one of them, or you won't be able to right now. So we'll have to save that for another time. But here are these 9 lies about work that you are fed. We need to peel them back and reveal the truths behind them. Here's the first lie. People care which company they work for. No, they don't. Nope. For there to be such a thing as a company culture, we ought to be able to study Facebook, the people that live and work at Facebook, and measure their lived experience at Facebook. And when we do that, we should be able to find 2 things. 1, the experience of working at Facebook is uniform. 2, the experience of working at Facebook is measurably or meaningfully different than working at Google, or at Tesla, or at Patagonia, or Goldman Sachs, or TELUS, or anywhere else. And it isn't. It never is with any company ever. You never find that in any company ever. There's no uniform experience, and the uniform experience isn't meaningfully or measurably different than another company's uniform experience. There's more variation of what a company's lived experience is like to work there inside a company than between companies. Always. All the stuff that you read about culture, it's all made up narrative. There's no such thing. The Fortune Best Companies to Work For list is the most read because it's talking about culture, and we sort of like that narrative, but it's not true. We care which company we join. Fortune Magazine's Best Companies to Work For list is a recruiting manual designed, it's peacock feathers for people, designed to lure you in, and that's okay. That's not bad. I'm not saying that's bad, but we ought to say what it is. People care which company they join, but once you're there, folks, you should know this. Everything to do with your experience there, how hard you work, how engaged you are, has nothing to do with the culture at all. It has everything to do with something else, which I don't have time to go into right now. So let's go into line number two. I can come back to it if you want. Best plan wins. Best plan, right now, September. Which company isn't in a planning phase? We build these planning systems. September, planning time. We show it to the board, the strategic plan. The board approves the strategic plan. It kind of comes down to the ranks in December, January. February, you get your version of the plan. But a plan is one of those weird things, isn't it? Where the better it is, the worse it works. The more detailed it is, the more filigreed it is, the more time it takes to put it together, the more likely it is that the real world has moved on. Plans help you engage super intelligently with the recent past. Planning's good, it helps you scope a problem. But no, plans, they don't help you win in the world. You don't need to build a planning system, you need a different sort of system. Here's another one, here's another lie that's fed at all of us. Best companies, they cascade goals. Which CEO isn't worried about alignment these days? Everyone's worried about alignment. We need to make sure that everyone's doing stuff that we want them to do when we're not there to tell them to do it. And the way we're going to do that is I'll come up with my goals. I'm the CEO. One level below me will be mini goals for my executive committee. Below that, mini goals and mini goals. Sometime around February, those mini goals hit you in your human capital management system. The field suddenly is auto-populated with goals. They come down upon you, don't you, these goals, like bad rain. And you're supposed to then use them to stay aligned. If that were true, then you'd have thought that all of us, because we know the world's dynamic, we know that the goals we set in January are irrelevant by the third week of January, aren't they? You'd have thought that all of us would be running back into our human capital systems and changing the goals every week or every other week, maybe every month, to reflect the changing reality that we all face. Which speaker up here these last 2 days hasn't talked about the rate of change? Of course things change. You'd have thought, well, we'll be running in there tweaking our goals. We don't. We know this from data. Less than 5% of you in this room even go back in and change your goals once you put them in. Or rather, we just know you go back in and look at them once. Most of you put them in the beginning of the year and you never look at them again. Well, sorry, some of you pop back in right at the end of the year and change them a little bit so they're a little slackier and a little stretchier than they might otherwise be so that you can get, you know, you can get the right rating. You can get the three, or maybe we'll say you're a four, or rather you would be a four, but we've run out of fours, and so you're going to get a three this year. How many times have we heard, sorry, we've run out of fours? Ha! Darn! We all do that, right? That's what this aligned... No, no, the best companies don't cascade goals. Whether you call them OKRs or MBOs or SMART goals, they're all useless. We know from data, I'm sorry, they are. The only manifestation of a good goal is one that you set for yourself, because a goal is a manifestation of what you value. Anything cascaded down upon you from above is an ungoal. Instead, we need to cascade something else. Four, I'm going to dive into this one in more detail. The best people are well-rounded. I'll come back to that one in a minute. Number five is what the article was about. The best people need feedback. People really want, particularly those millennials, they love that feedback. And how many times have you heard this these days? Feedback is like a gift. It's a gift. Come in, sit down. I want to give you some feedback. Yeah, feedback is a gift, like an anvil is a gift. Whenever, how many times have you heard that phrase? Come in, sit down. I want to give you feedback. And immediately you tense. What we can see in your brain is your brain goes into a brain pattern that looks an awful lot like flight or fight. You're immediately defending yourself. And the one thing that leaves that conversation almost immediately is your brain. We instinctively know that the other person is not a source of truth about us. and they're not a source of truth about what we should do differently to get better. We instinctively know that. And so we have to survive the experience of feedback. And now, oh my word, we're turning into a god. Everyone should have feedback. No, no, we need something else. No one likes feedback. And if you don't believe that, just get married. It's a joke, I think it's a joke. Okay, keep rolling along. Number six is the one I was talking about with Richard. People can reliably rate other people. I know this sounds a bit wonky, a bit inside baseball. Your entire career is based on that lie. Your entire future is based on that lie. Maybe not all of you. If you, as we heard just before, trying to get funding for your business, maybe you just wait for somebody to just decide if they believe in your idea. But for all of us who are employees or team members, team leaders, they're mediated through ratings that aren't real. They are desperately wrong. And the more data we add, the worse they get. Seven, this one, people have potential. No, they don't. Come on. I mean, it sounds like we should all have a growth mindset. People have potential. And yes, of course, Richard has potential. Richard has potential. One person has very specific potential based upon his role and job. Most of these lies start off as a truth in one little set of circumstances, and they become a lie spread across all of us. So yeah, Richard can grow and get better, but most companies don't just say that about Richard. They say Richard has a bucket, and in the bucket is a substance, probably green, fluorescent, and it's called potential, and he carries it around with him. It's like a turbocharger. Wherever he goes, whatever job he's in, it sort of turbocharges his learning and his contribution, his performance. And we have a name for you, Richard, because your bucket is almost full with this lovely green stuff. We call you a, well, what do we call him if he has lots of this potential? We call him a hypo. We call him a high potential. He's a hypo. Walks around with it on his back. He's proud of it. You really can't get rid of that, by the way. Doesn't matter how bad you are, Richard. You're going to carry that with the rest of your career. It's called a high potential. You, and I'm sorry, what was your name again? Sorry? Julia. Yeah, as with most people like you, Julia, we forget your name like that because you have a bucket, but it has a hole in it. And there's not much of the green stuff left. Maybe there was never much in there in the first place. I'm sorry, what was your name? Julia, okay. You're a lopo. You're a nopo. Hypo, lopo. 15% of people in Canada are designated a hypo. Everyone else is... Julia, sorry. And you take up space. That's what you do. And we've created, and I'm joking a little bit, but I'm not really, am I? Pretty much every company does this. Richard, you've got a lot of potential. Julia, yeah, give her a hug, because... But look at that. What a perfect apartheid we've created, where we've got lots of Richards to invest in. Everyone else is just a lopo. Yeah, there's no such thing called potential. I've been in the psychometric measurement business for my entire career. You can't measure that. That doesn't exist. There is no substance, there's nothing in Richard's head that is transferable, situation to situation to situation, that turbocharges his learning or his performance or his growth. That is not findable. It's made up because we like to tidy up the messiness of the world and create two categories, Richard and Julia, hypo, lopo. We do it all the time and it's a disaster for us. Two more real quick. Work-life balance matters most. Just a little hang on the word balance. Balance is so flipping precarious, isn't it? You find that one moment of balance. Whoever finds that? But by the way, if you ever did, man or woman, young or old, rich or poor, if you found balance, Thursday morning, 9 o'clock, you're like, I got it. The kids are happy. The bank account's good. My parents seem okay. If that ever happened to you, you know what would be running through your head? Nobody move. Shh, I got it. Balance is stasis. We used to think that the planets hung in balance. That's why we like balance, because it looked like everything was in balance. But it's only because we didn't realize we lived such short lives. Once we got the full range of time in our minds, we realized that nothing's in balance. Everything moves. Nothing in nature is in balance that's healthy. Everything's moving. Everything's motion. Balance as an aspiration is an awful thing to lay upon somebody, to designate them to fail consistently. There's a better thing to strive for. Number nine is the last one. Leadership is the thing. That idea is based on the idea we get the best leaders, we line them up against the wall, and then we look at them, interview them, maybe, give them a 360, maybe, and we find out that they've got these qualities. They've all got these qualities. All these leaders have a quality called, we'll call it leadership, and we'll break it down into competencies and put it in a model. Normally the model is a circle, I don't know why. Sometimes it's a triangle. always its primary colors. Don't know why all leadership models have to be primary colors. But if you want to be a leader, you've got to get this thing. It's called leadership. Maybe you could put it in your bucket, Richard. The funny thing is, though, when you study the best leaders, as you all know, just as you've seen so many up here the last couple of days, they're all different. They're all different. So if every single leader out there is different, then every one of these qualities of leadership is optional. Well, how daft is that? There's no such thing as leadership. There are leaders, and they seem to get other people to want to work really hard for them, so there are leaders. Don't imagine there's ever such a thing as leadership. There isn't. It's made up, just like potential is made up. Feedback, all this is just made up. So here are these 9 lies that affect pretty much everything you do when you try to build a great tech company, when you try to build a great agile team, when you try to sell and build a great sales force. These things are pushed at you. The third one, obviously, you know, pushes sales quotas. You've got ones across the top here that talk about models and competencies and things you should all have, ratings that we're going to put inside some sort of human capital system forever. All of this is work. This is how you get understood at work, and it's all made up. I'm going to dive into one of them. If you want to dive into all of them, Harvard Business Review and I put together this thing called freethinkingleader.org, where we've taken every lie, every truth, every lie, every truth. So if any of you, I know you're getting a free book, which is great, but if you don't like books and you want to just look at a shorthand of lie, truth, then go to freethinkingleader.org. You'll see Ashley talking about it at Cisco. You'll see me talking about it in terms of the research. And it's really just, we were trying to offer it to you to say, come on, let's make change, because this isn't working. Those lies are not working. Now, we could dive into a bunch of them, but I thought I would pick in the last sort of 15, 16 minutes here, I just pick one of them to dive into, and I'll try to use it to explain maybe line number 8 and line number 5 a bit as well. The one I thought I'd start with is this one. Well-rounded people are better, or rather, the best people are well-rounded. We know this. I was sharing this morning with some other folks here in a masterclass. If you ask Canadian parents this question, your child comes home with English A or French A, Social Studies A, Biology C, Algebra F. Which grade deserves the most attention from you? We didn't say all attention, just said most. You've only got time to invest in your kid. Which grade deserves the most attention? We've asked this question every year for the last 25 years. There isn't a single year where less than 70% of Canadian parents go with the F. We all go with the F. So does the US, so does Britain, so does Argentina, so does New Zealand, so does Germany. There isn't a single country in the world when you present parents with that choice where every parent goes, A, whatever, F, fix the kid, kid's broken, fix the kid. Why? Because a good kid, I mean a really good kid, the best kid is a well-rounded kid. The best student is a well-rounded student. And then we get to work. The best employee is a well-rounded employee. 2 minutes on what you did well last year in your performance review, 58 minutes on your areas of opportunity. I mean, that's what we call them because the perfect employee is well-rounded. Obviously, you take a free-thinking research approach to this, though, and you don't see that in the world, do you? Why do we build our entire people systems around this idea? School, all the way through work. When you look at the reality of the world, and you see excellence, and it's not well-rounded. You think about excellence. I mean, average looks well. All average, tennis players or golfers, they all look the same. The best ones all look weirdly different. I mean, you take Richard Branson and Warren Buffett, two white men, same age roughly, both entrepreneurs, hugely successful. Could they be any more different? Of course they couldn't. And there's no one in this room that would go, hey, Warren, just work at it. You could be like Richard. You could grow your hair. You could get some dental work. Just a little dental work would help, I think. And then Richard, you cherry coke, man, move to Omaha. It's stupid. And yet that's what we do all the time. Now, I could take examples from, entertainment. I thought I'd pick one just to bring this to life for you. Sport. I'll pick one from sport. And I picked a sport that I know, because I'm from England originally. We have a sport over there called football. And we call it football because you play it with a foot, okay? Why is that? Over here it's called soccer, isn't it? Because you have a sock on or something. Anyway, who's the best player in the world right now? Messi, I think. I mean, we could say Ronaldo, have an argument. But two days ago, he won, didn't he? Won the best football player in the world. So objectively, right now, Lionel Messi, for those of you who don't know, Lionel Messi, probably the best player ever to play the game. He plays for a club called Barcelona. And if you don't know what excellence in the world looks like, just go Google Lionel Messi dribbles on YouTube, and you'll get thousands upon thousands of these examples. One of them stands out. I'm going to show it to you. One of them stands out. It's a goal he scored against the Atletico Bilbao in the Copa del Rey, 2015. It was 0-0. He gets the ball at the halfway line, and you can see him pass it back to the right back, and he gets the ball back, and he stands there at the halfway line, and you can sort of see him thinking, I wonder what I should do now. And then you'll see what he does now. This goal is so brilliant that ESPN actually took it and turned it into a 30-minute program, all about how fast he was going, how many taps he had with the ball, and what's the distance between him and it's a beautiful example of excellence in action. So have a look at it. No preconceived ideas. Take a free-thinking research approach to this example of excellence. Some of you know soccer. Some of you don't. I found two things. I'm going to share two things that I saw when I looked at this. You might find other things. I'm not suggesting my two are right. I'm suggesting that all of us get better at looking at examples of excellence and just seeing them from the way they are. So this is Lionel Messi's goal against Atletico Bilbao. He's the little chap at the bottom. I don't know which screens it's going to come up on, but he's down at the bottom. He gets the ball, passes it back, gets it again, and then he does something.
The fact they do have that policy in terms of their player selection makes it all the more remarkable that, along with Barcelona and Real Madrid, Athletic Bilbao have never been relegated from the Primera Division.
It's something to be admired, I have to say. Well, there's three of them right, he's still going. Look at this, Kevin.
It's a brilliant run from Messi. Can he go all the way? It's one of the great Copa del Rey final goals.
For those of you who don't know soccer, that's really hard. What he just did there, that's not easy. That's actually really hard. Seven defenders between him and the goal. You're not supposed to be able to do that. And yet he did that. And it's just sort of unbelievable. He does this all the time. It's just unbelievable. But one of the things, I don't know what you noticed as you watched the players around him and what he did and how he juked and why did he go for the near post, all sorts of interesting things if you really like the game. But the thing that I noticed as he went from the halfway line to the penalty area and shot the shot and scored, that he only used, I don't know whether you noticed this, he only used one foot, his left foot. His one right there, and then left, 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 jukes, left, shoots, left, scores. Here, just look at it again. Left, left, one right there, left, 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 and then one right, and then left, left. Should use his right, but he doesn't. Left, 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 shoots, short. Left, 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 left. For those of you not counting along, it's 19 touches with his left foot to 2 touches to his right foot. And that's not an anomaly. Every single one, if you really just count a lot of his dribbles, his ratio is basically 10 to 1. Dominant foot to less dominant. Now, Ronaldo, also a really good player, he's right-footed. His ratio is 4.5 to 1, which just goes to show that I have no life. it does sound so stupid. You must have sat there counting. Yeah, okay, fine. But I wanted to know how anomalous this was. This is a super anomaly. If you were to make a player, if you were to design a well-rounded soccer player, it wouldn't look like that. It would look like Ronaldo without the ego. It would look like this. But he's 5'6.5". They say he's 5'7". He is. He's 5'6". He was born in Rosario, port town in Argentina. And the scouts heard about this little kid from Argentina. They came from far away, and they went, ooh, you come here. And they brought him, some of you know this story, they brought him to La Masia, which is the farmhouse, which is where they grew their talent. And they worked on, and they said, look, work on your right foot. Work on your right. Work on your head. We'll give you extra cookie if you score with your head. They literally said that. And they also gave him hormones, growth hormones, in his thigh every day. Growth hormones. Get bigger, but you're too short. You get bigger, bigger. And at 15, he's like, I'm done. I'm going home. I'm done. And they went, oh, okay. Then we'll change your regimen. We'll just say two things for you, which for you as leaders, you might want to remember. They just said two things. One, they said, be dangerous. Wherever you are on the field, be dangerous. They define the job by the outcome, not the method. He's on the halfway line. He was just like, I think I'll be dangerous now. He shouldn't have followed that path. He should have passed it and passed it. He didn't, just. So be dangerous, Lionel, wherever you are. The second thing they said, which is super interesting, they said, just work on your left foot. Work on your left foot. When I told you that he's only got a left foot, that's not a secret. You don't have to sign an NDA. Everyone knows it. Everyone who follows soccer knows that it's a massively dominant left foot. You know which people know it more than ever? Or any of us in this room? The seven defenders on the field. For those of you who know soccer, you saw what they were trying to do, didn't you? Those of you who know soccer? They were trying to marshal him into the far right-hand corner. Why? Because he can't cross with his right foot. Everyone knows that. What did he do? He just broke the trap. Because he got his foot so fast, so speedy, that it was bamboozling, even to people who are probably some of the best defenders in the world. What they realized is what all brain scientists realize. He will grow most in the area where he's already shown some comparative advantage. Whether you call that a strength or a talent or an attribute, I don't know. But you grow most. Neuroscientists know you grow more synaptic connections in the areas of your brain you have the most pre-existing synaptic connections. You should remember this for the rest of your life. When you have kids or not, whether you're working with a team or not, people grow most where they've already shown some natural advantage. Learning, according to brain scientists, is like new buds on an existing branch. It's not new branches. It doesn't mean you ignore the right foot. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, where's the ROI? It's not growth mindset versus fixed mindset. That's not the point. The point is, where will you grow most? Every one of you is in the business of ROI, thinking about ROI. Where will you get the best return? When it comes to a human being, you get the best return by maximizing that left foot, which means if any of you are leading a team, here's a new ritual for you. Stop feedbacking and do what we just did for Lionel. We did strengths replay, didn't we? So many of us as team leaders run through the world of work going, stop that, whoa, stop that, not that, stop that. Maybe you should have a new high priority interrupt command for yourself. Not stop that, but that. What was that? What was that? When you wrote that email and everyone lent in, what was that? When you closed that deal, what was that? When you actually persuaded that customer to come around, what was that? What was that? What's going through? Why wouldn't we replay things that work? So often we think as team leaders that good job is the end of a sentence. Good job, little pats on the head. No, if you want to get better as a leader, good job is the beginning of a sentence. You don't just celebrate something that works, you interrogate it. That's what the best leaders do. You interrogate excellence. When that worked and you turned that customer around, what was going on in your mind? What were you thinking? Why did you do that? Why did you think that? Remember, all learning is insight. So your job as a leader is to catch people doing something that really works and go, whoa, that. What was that? Maybe not quite as annoyingly as I just did then, but something where you stop the river of work and go, whoa, that. If you want to be attractive to talent, seriously, I promise you, the most attractive thing you can be to talent isn't patty on the heady. It's, hey, step it up. I saw that thing you did worked. I'm not saying that we shouldn't deal with your right foot, but I saw that left foot. Now, do you know why that worked for you? What was going through your head when you were doing it? Can you play that again? Could we reframe it, reprise it? Could we find different ways in which to apply it? That's what great team leadership is, whether you're running a team of engineers, team of marketers, or salespeople. Replay, strengths replay. Don't celebrate success, interrogate it. Because that's so seductive if you're Lionel. Now. So that's the first thing I pulled away from this, that he took his left foot and he manifested it in a way that was, somebody realized that it could be turned into a weapon that was almost unmarkable, almost unplayable. The second thing, this is the last thing I'll share with you for 5 minutes, then we'll be done. Just look how happy that guy is. 84% of people who come to work in Canada don't feel like that. I know that. I have the data on that. They don't. And yet you look at that. Every one of you in this room, you, one of the reasons you came to Elevate, you wanted to feel like that to some extent. How do you feel like that? And of course you look at that and you go, well, he loves what he does because he's a soccer player and he earns a good million. He just scored a goal. He just scored a goal. But you look at him in interviews and he feels like he just is in love with his work. For those of you that have ever seen him, you can see there's something in there that's beautiful that he loves. Now, I am not saying do what you love. That's not my takeaway. Maybe it's yours. I don't know. That's not my takeaway. Whenever I hear somebody say do what you love, I kind of want to punch him because, sorry, but it's like you think to yourself, I don't know what I love. Do what I love? And besides, even if I did do what I love, no one's going to pay me for it. I love singing in the shower, but I scare the hyenas when I do. It's like, why do you have hyenas? Anyway. Point is, very, very few of us know that what we love is X and that someone's going to pay for X. It's way more complicated than that, isn't it? And yet, I know some of you probably think, no one cares about what I love. Let's just linger on that for a minute before we break for lunch. Raise your hand if any of you've ever been in love. Okay, keep your eyes closed for a second. Keep your hand up and try to remember what it was like when you were in love. Before you saw the person, time seemed to drag on, didn't it? And you just never, and then when you were with him for the day, it just felt you were with them for 2 minutes, just whoa, whipped by the time. And then when you were not with them anymore, time dragged on again. Okay, put, put your hands down. Weren't you amazing when you were in love? Weren't you just, when you're in love, the world is friendly, people are filled with joy, you see it, you're generous in your opinions, you're open, you're resilient, you're warm, you have grit, but also creativity, you're persistent, you're open, you're wonderful, you're amazing when you're in love. Now you think about the adjectives that every CEO wants from you. They want you to be creative, resilient, open, engaging, persistent, resilient, reliant. They want all those. But of course you don't get those by writing them on a break room wall or putting them in the employee handbook. You get them because they're built out of love. And I know some of you don't want to use that word, but that's way when we are in love, we are these beautiful, big, open things. We've got to deal with it. We don't necessarily need to have jobs that we love, but we do need to find love in what we do. One of the worst jobs to have in the world at the moment is a doctor. It's terrible to be a physician. Physicians have twice as high levels of PTSD than veterans who are coming back from war zones. 73% of doctors wouldn't advocate being doctors to their kids. The only thing worse than being a doctor is being an emergency room nurse. That's the least engaging of all professions, which when you think about it, if you want to, as Simon Sinek would say, and I think rightly, you start with why. Boy, they have a why. God, amazing why. And yet they're all deeply, deeply disengaged. There's a huge problem in Canada and the US. So the Mayo Clinic's done a bunch of research on this, looking at doctors who are not burned out and try to figure out what's different about these doctors. Turns out not much, but one of the things they do have in common, they have at least 20% of activities in their job are what they love, 20%. With each percentage point reduction below that, 19, 18, 17, there is a commensurate, almost linear relationship in the decrease in resilience and the increase in burnout. It's almost perfect. But above 20%, if you go 25% doing what you love, or 30%, or 40%, there's no commensurate increase in resilience or decrease in burnout. It's almost like 20% is like a threshold. A little love seems to go a long way. So you might think to yourself, all right, well, how would I do that? How do I find love in what I do? Just by way of closing, let me just give you this. You've never done this. It'll cost you nothing. But if you don't do it, no one will ever do it for you. Try spending a week in love with your job. What that means is take a blank pad of rhyme with you, draw a line down the middle of it. At the top of one column, write loved it. At the top of the other column, write loathed it. And any time during that week you see one of the signs of love, before you do it, you positively anticipate it. While you're doing it, as Mike Cheshire-Mahai would say, you experience flow. When you're done with it, ooh, you kind of want to do it again. Scribble it down in the loved it column. Scribble down what activity you're actually doing in the loved it column. And in the loathed it, anytime you see one of the signs of loathe, before you're doing it, you're trying to procrastinate it. Sort of shove it off to the new guy because it'll be developmental or whatever it is. Or when you're doing it, time just drags on. When you're done with it, you're like this. Put it in the loathed it column. And you'll end up using this, the raw material of a regular week of your job. You'll see which activities have invigoration, love in them, and which don't. No one can do this but you. You might think of these activities in the loved it column as red threads, red threads. Your work, your life, is made up of many threads, many activities, situations, responsibilities. Some are brown, some are white, some are gray, some are black, but some of them are red. Some of these activities are things that invigorate you, that you lean into, that make you feel like that. We don't know what they are. I have an elder brother and a younger sister. They have totally different ones than me. My younger sister was a ballet dancer. I am not, clearly. My brother was a composer. I had a musical ectomy at birth. I don't know why, but I didn't. No musical talent at all, or love for it. You're so different from your brother. You're so different from your sister. It's nothing to do with your race, your gender, your age. It's irrelevant. There are certain activities in life that invigorate you. What the Mayo Clinic research is telling you is, could you please weave them into a fabric that is strong? Because then you will carry us. Then you will make a contribution. Find your red threads and weave them into something valuable. When you don't, when you lose your threads, and some of you have, some of you have mistaken a strength as what you're good at, and so you were good at, I don't know, pre-med, and you became a really grumpy doctor. Some of you have mistaken what your red threads are, and you've lost them. When you do, you're a worse human, you're more fragile. You reach toward groups that look and feel like you because it's amity within, enmity without. It's fearful, and there's a lot of that today. I'm going to give you one example here of one person who lost his threads and then did what some of you might have done. He found the frayed end of one red thread, and he wove it into a beautiful contribution. He's a dancer. I'm rather like the Barcelona team, the Royal Ballet Company, scouts talent all the time. About 15 years ago, they found a 9-year-old gymnast in a town outside of Kiev, and they went, "Oh, I think he might have the best raw talent I've ever seen." They brought him over to White Lodge, which is the Royal Ballet Training School in Richmond Park in London, and they trained him and they trained him and they trained him. And lo and behold, at 19, he's the best male ballet dancer in the world. He's the youngest principal male dancer in the history, 250-year history of the Royal Ballet Company. Some said he was better than Nureyev, better than Baryshnikov. For those of you who know your ballet, some were even saying he was better than Nijinsky back in the 20s. He was amazing. And London was so proud that we had him. Parisians don't have him, Russians don't. We got him. And we made him dance the Royal Ballet way, the strictures of the Royal Ballet way. We didn't look at his red threads. We didn't care. The signs of tattoos all over his body giving us a clue that he might be a little bit weird in terms of his red threads. We ignored those, and we just put him in the meat grinder of the Royal Ballet way of dancing. You've done that sometimes with yourself or your people. And at 21, 2 years after he becomes the youngest principal male dancer ever, he quits. He's burned out. He's done. He flails around London for about 2 years, and then he does what some of you might have done. He just finds that frayed end of a red thread, and he just pulls it, because it's only the only thing he knows really now. The one thing he knows is how he likes to dance. And he goes to his friend and says, "Could you choreograph with me a piece that manifests my red threads?" And together they put something together, they put it on film, and on a couple of days, one day after Valentine's Day, 2015, they put it online. I'm gonna show you the last 20 seconds of it, and then we'll be done. Now 29 million people have seen it. Maybe you've seen it. It's Sergei Polonin dancing his particular choreography to Hoxha's Take Me to Church. I'm gonna show it to you as one other example of real world excellence. I don't know what you'd find from it. If you wanna see the whole thing, just go look at it on YouTube. But I'm gonna tell you one thing that I see when I look at this. This is Sergei Polonin dancing, pulling on that one red thread and dancing to Take Me to Church. I don't know what you see when you look at that. I see someone who's taken themselves super seriously. I see someone who, in extremis, has found one red thread that made sense for him and has figured out a way not to individualistically be self-indulgent with it, but to figure out a way to weave it into a contribution from which we can all benefit. I see someone who's authentic and real, and the reason why 29 million people, even those who flip and hate ballet, have watched it is because there's something powerful and beautiful and authentic in it. We were hearing this morning about the importance of an authentic customer experience. You don't get it without love. That is a person who's taken seriously the uniqueness of their uniqueness. When we say people are our greatest asset, what we mean is each person, not people, each person. And the power of human nature is that each human's nature is unique. That's its power. That's not a bug for us to fix. All those nine lies trying to fix the bug of human uniqueness, that is a feature to be maximized. Every single one of you has unique red threads. We are waiting for you to take seriously the uniqueness of your uniqueness. We are waiting for you to find your red threads. We are your family, we're your friends, we're your colleagues at work, we're your customers, we're your country. We are waiting for you to take seriously those red threads and weave them into something fine and weird and strong. And all I wanted to share with you this morning is please don't make us wait too long.
Thanks for being with us today on Jeanette's TV. I'm your host, Jeanette Burke, signing off. Please remember to like, comment, and share all our posts with your family and friends. You will find us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Pinterest, Vimeo, YouTube, you name it, we're there. Hashtag Jeanette's TV. And until next time, continue to be fabulous.